All right, so today I'm going to be talking about environmental parameters associated with stable fly development, primarily at hay bale feeders, but I'm going to give you a little more information outside of that as well. As you can see from the author list here, there's quite a few people that were involved in this study. It was quite an effort of time and resources to do this project. So I just acknowledge everyone that's there. All right, so why do we care about stable flies? Well, I think Chris did a pretty good job in the previous presentation. Essentially, stable flies are blood feeders. I really like these SEM micrographs that Dr. Brosi, when he was at Kansas State University, took to really kind of drive home this point of why we care about stable flies. So these are SEM micrographs of the adult. This is the business end of the proboscis. And as you can see, this is the reason why. Just leaning against it. All right, so this is the reason why we care about it, because at the tip of the proboscis, they're actually not sucking flies, a lot like mosquitoes are, right? So when mosquitoes take a blood meal, it's a lot like a hypodermic needle or a syringe that finds the blood through the capillaries. Stable flies are not like that. When they take a blood meal, they actually abrade the surface of the skin, and they actually create like a pool of blood, and then they feed on that. And when they do that, as you can imagine, that hurts quite a bit. In some places, they're actually known as the dog fly, and this is a picture in northeast Montana that I took. And it's not uncommon to find them associated with dogs in places that have really thin skin, maybe aren't as protected. So for instance, here are the ears, and this is kind of a close-up shot. And it's a little hard to see here, but the stable flies have actually abraded the skin here to the point that it's scarring the tissue. On pelicans that are immunocompromised, like this one, is infected with West Nile virus. That, in fact, is a little more obvious. So you can see stable flies are attacking it to the point where it's actually openly weeping blood. Oops. Keep leaning. Okay, so this is kind of why we really care about stable flies. They do attack most animals and humans, and for humans it's kind of an inconvenience. But the reason why really there's a lot of time and energy spent into controlling stable flies is because of this. They primarily like to attack cattle. And when they attack cattle, they like to attack, it looks like, the lower regions. And when they attack, if you can imagine those painful bites, the cattle are going to do what they can to protect their legs. So if there's a body of water, this is one method of defense. They're going to find it and stand in it because they're trying to protect their legs. And I can tell you that this is not what a producer likes to see. Okay, other forms of defense include bunching, which you can see in the upper left and upper right-hand side. And when the animal does that, there's a couple of things that happen. One of them is that there's an incredible amount of stress on the animal, both emotionally as it's trying to get away from the pest, but also if you can imagine on a hot summer day, these animals bunching together in the middle of a pasture, they get quite hot. Some other common behaviors that we see is this tail flicking. Also, you'll see some leg stomping. Sometimes you'll see tail flicking, leg stomping, and head throws. And all of these have metabolic costs that are associated with them. And so the take-home message here is that whenever an animal is doing this, there's a metabolic cost associated with that. When they're standing in the middle of a field or in a water, they're not grazing, right? So the producer is left with decreased weight gains at the end of the season. So it's primarily why we study them. All right, so again, Chris, I think, did a wonderful job kind of covering the bases of control here. So I'm not going to talk about the adult life cycle too much. I'm going to focus in on the larval stage. But I would like to mention, again, just kind of bringing home the point that Chris made, which is that because the immature stages, so the egg, the larva, and the pupa, those are in one kind of environment, right? I mean, that's obvious for the entomologists in the room. But it's always important to remember that the adult also occupies a different environmental niche completely. I mean, they're almost like two different organisms. And so anyone who's attempting to implement an effective integrated pest management program really should be looking at this from a holistic point of view and at least targeting at least one of the immature stages and the adult stage. But as Chris mentioned, right now, sort of the first line of defense is to clean up the larval habitat. The problem with that is that we don't really understand larval ecology. So stable flies, here in the United States anyway, We tend to typically find them whenever there's a mixture of decomposing vegetation, such as animal bedding or hay residue around these hay bales, that's mixed in with like urine or precipitation. But you know, there are other reports of them developing in places that are completely different. Like for instance, you'll find them in solids that are around, like this was at a dairy lagoon right here. There are reports of them developing in accumulated mayfly carcasses or accumulated seaweed on the sides of a beach. Dave, I don't know if he's here or not, but at some point he's going to be giving a presentation about what's going on in Costa Rica, in which there's absolutely no manure involved in that. It's just crop residue. And apparently that's going on in Australia as well. So why are they developing in these different substrate habitats is basically the overlying question. What is it that they need for nutrition and for development? Okay, so in order to approach this from an ecological point of view, I adapted a definition from Morrison Blackwood about the ecology of soil-dwelling microorganisms. And on some point, this can be loosely applied to stable flies as well. So we can look at it from the individual point of view, in which we look at the abiotic factors on the physiology and behavior. We can look at it from the population point of view, so looking at intra-specific competition. From the community point of view, which is looking at interspecific competition, and then from an ecosystems ecology point of view, so really looking at food nutrition and nutrient transfers in the environment. So I'm going to primarily talk about the individual point of view. I've got two things to share with you today about that, and I'm going to briefly just mention how we're approaching the other points of views. So the first objective that we had is really simple. And that I just wanted to know what the stable fly larvae look like. And the rationale behind this is that right now there's sort of this opinion that I keep hearing, and that because the females are really determining where the larvae are going to be, right? Because it's the females that oviposit in these larval developmental sites, and how far can a larva really go? And so there's sort of an implication in that thinking, and that the larvae are just kind of aimlessly wandering through their environment. And I wanted to know, like, I just kind of don't think that's true. And so one of the ways that we approached that was asking this question of what does it look like, and specifically, what kind of receptors do they have? So how are they interacting with their environment? And we did this just by doing a scanning electron micrographs of the first, second, and third instars. So this is the first, second, and third instar. And as a point of reference, for other people who aren't entomologists in the room, it's kind of interesting. At room temperature, stable fly larvae will remain in the first instar for only 24 hours. It's very quick. The second instar is about the same, it's only 24 hours. And then for about 5 days, it's in the third instar phase. So that's primarily where it spends most of its larval life history. Okay, so this is kind of an up-close view of our character. And I'm going to briefly go through the structures here. So what we're looking at is a pseudocephalon. A little more quickly, I'll go into a little detail about that. They have antennae, maxillary palpi, the ventral organ. This is what's called the facial mask, the labial lobe, and this is simply called the anterior spinous band, because essentially they're spines. And so we didn't actually figure out the function of this, which is, you know, that's a story in and of itself. You really have to dig through the literature to really find out, you know, what the functions of these things are. And if you take the time to do that, which I encourage everyone to do, there are some jewels, actually. People used to do some amazing work in the 40s and the 30s. That's definitely worth the time to, like, go back and find that and read it. Because somewhere along the line, that information's been lost. And even in current manuscripts that are published by well-respected scientists who do a really good job, they miss a lot of stuff. And they call things receptors that aren't. And it's actually been shown that pretty definitively in the literature. But I would say from the 70s on, there's been a real discrepancy, a real loss in that knowledge. Okay, so without getting off my soapbox on that then. Okay, so they do have antennae, which is kind of embarrassing to say, but I was surprised that larvae have antennae. And they can't actually smell. This is the business end up here. They have maxillary palpi, which are primarily used to taste things, but they also include mechanoreceptors. The ventral organ is primarily a mechanoreceptor. Three of these pores are mechanoreceptors. One is a taste receptor. And then they have this labial lobe, which, as far as I know, no one really knows what it does. But they also have a couple of pairs of organs. If anyone here has insight into that, I would love for you to talk to me after the talk. All right, so moving on to the facial mask then. This is used primarily to disseminate saliva, which means that also in the larvae, it looks like that there's extra oral digestion going on in the environment, which means it's probably not just bacteria that they're ingesting, right? They're probably also digesting some sort of solid material that's bigger than the mouth opening. They also have this anterior spinospan, which people don't really know what it does, right? You can't find that in the literature as far as I could tell. But we noticed as we started looking at these bands that it appears like they can actually cusp. And they've got these cool little finger-like appendages associated with it. And we happened to catch an SEM where the pseudocephalon was actually partially retracted. And when we closed up, or when we zoomed in on this area right here, you could see that the oral grooves of the facial mask were almost like perfectly fitted by these bands as they were coming up to meet it. So there's a possibility, again, this isn't definitive, it's just an observation, that these anterior spinous bands may be involved in extra oral digestion somehow, in terms of maybe like pulling the food up towards the mouth, and as it sort of partially retracts the head, it creates this sort of like pocket for pre-digestion, possibly. And it's something to look into. All right, so moving on to the thorax. We have the first and second, third sections of the thorax, and they're easily marked by the Keeling's organs. Here's a close-up picture of this, which we think are hygroreceptors, where they measure moisture content in the environment. Very close to these hygroreceptors are mechanoreceptors, or campaniform scintilla. And in the second and third instars, you can see it kind of waving out at you right here, are the anterior spiracles, which are used for respiration. They're not present in the first instar. And then moving on to the posterior section, or the abdomen, this is the ventral view, and this is the dorsal view. So in the ventral view, we have two primary structures that really stand out. One is the anal organ, which is used for osmoregulation, and it's actually this entire structure right here. And there are also welts, which are used in movement. And then finally, we have the posterior spiracle, which is used by the organism for respiration and by entomologists for identification. So the breathing part of this actually comes through these S-shaped slits, which are called peritremes. And that's a really cool function too. You should read that paper. Okay, so the conclusion from this is that stable fly larvae are probably not just randomly wandering through their environment, right? They're probably interacting at least on some level with their environment. So the next question is, well then why are they where they are? And, you know, sort of related, why aren't they in similar environments? So to answer those questions, we did some intensive sampling of the physiochemical parameters at one of the common sites of stable fly development here in the Midwest, and that's in the hay residue that's by the hay bales, which Chris pointed out. And so essentially what happens is that these are very common in the pastures. As the cows come up to feed, you know, a lot of that doesn't make it into the mouth, it just kind of falls to the ground. And so you get this perfect accumulation of decomposing vegetation that gets mixed in with grain or urine, manure, and it's just a really good site for development. So we wanted to know, if we took soil cores or sample cores from that developmental site, could we identify some of the physiochemical properties of that site and say stable fly larvae like it when the pH is this? Or can you find stable fly larvae when, for instance, the electrical conductivity is this? That was really the goal of this project. And so we measured, we took samples from 9 hay rings between 2005 and 2011. It was an 11.5 centimeter diameter core that we took. We measured larval abundance, electrical conductivity, pH, moisture content, ammonium, nitrogen, carbon, temperature, bacteria, and which zone, which was radiating out from the middle of that because there's microbiologists in the room, part of the bacterial part, I put a little more detail in there, of essentially the enumeration of total coliforms, E. coli, and Enterococcus with the QuantiTrace system. And then we also plated samples onto McConkey auger, TSA, and M. Entero auger with the Eddie Judd spiral plater. And that was to compare results that were published already. Okay, so here's the thing, is that we had an incredible team of people that were involved in this, and so these results are kind of disappointing, because exactly, basically what this says is, if you're looking at the probability of finding larvae, and you look at each of those parameters, such as depth of residue, EC, ammonia, moisture, temperature, and weak, basically, the best we could do is come up with a 50-50 chance of finding stable fly larvae, if you looked at any of those parameters, which is probably not surprising, right? Because we know it's a complex environment, it's not homogenous, and there's probably a lot going on here. But you know, when you have a lot of people working really hard on something, you know, it would be nice to have like a, oh, the pH has to be like 8 or 8.5. That's just not what happened. But what we were able to do is, you know, it's not like all is lost here. We are still augmenting this definition of what is suitable stable fly habitat, right? Because it seems like people have wildly different measurements, whether you're in like the La Reunion Island, which we have measurements coming from over there, or Australia, or Costa Rica. So, you know, the way I see this is kind of like a small piece of a puzzle that we need more of the pieces in to really figure out what's going on. It is interesting to note here, I mean, this isn't surprising either with some of the life history data that's been published, in that there's an inverse relationship between the probability of finding stable fly larvae and the temperature. And there's also an inverse relationship between finding them over time in the hay residue. Just keep that in mind. And then we also figured out what did each of these substrates or properties look like over time. So we bend it up according to degree day. We looked at it, like for instance, probability of finding larvae decreased over time, the depth slightly decreased, EC slightly decreased, ammonium slightly decreased, moisture kind of decreased, and then as you would expect, summer kind of did this hyperbolic thing where, you know, it gets hotter as the summer increases and then cools off in the fall. We also looked at the bacteria, and without going into too much detail, everything decreased over time except for the total coliforms. It's kind of fluctuated a lot, so that basically by the end of it all, it looked like it was just a straight line. So, something that I do want to spend just a couple of minutes, how much time do I have left?
2 minutes,
okay. I'm going to do this really fast then. We did a PCA analysis, basically, where we combined all of these parameters. And the question that I had is this it? Because I think that there's something phenologically going on with the adults that's not accounted for, just the larval substrate. And there seems to be a discussion right now that adult abundance is dictated solely by the quality of the local larval substrate. And I don't think that's true, and I'll go into the reason for that in a minute. And without going into the results of this too much, this basically supports that hypothesis, such that when you do a regression on the best possible combination of these factors, time still accounts for something, and it's very significant. Okay, and so where this observation comes from, we do a lot of work at a dairy. Here's the two dairy barns right here, but they also have a calf operation. And when the calves are old enough, they move them into these grouped pens, about 5 or 6 in sections of 6 pens right here. And there's about 3 of these pens. And the beautiful thing about this is that when they move these groups of calves into these pens, they put them in there only for about 6 weeks. Then they move the calves out, they scrape out all of the substrate that's in there, and then they start all over again, replace it with brand new substrate. And what we find is that we have basically continual refreshment of substrate, right? So the idea would be then that possibly stable flies should be developing in this, right, all summer. And what we find is that that's not true. We'll find stable fly larvae at about this point. This is the adult phenology. This is very typical in Nebraska. We see sort of an early summer peak. As the temperatures increase, stable fly abundance decreases. And in the fall, we see this second peak. In this substrate, stable fly larvae are very common, and we'll find them at about here and then through this whole peak And then, you know, understandably, they kind of go away. But at this point, when we see the fall peak, we still don't see stable fly larvae in that substrate. So what's going on? I mean, the substrate's being refreshed. So there's something outside of that that's happening that we don't know yet. But we're on track for that. Okay. So I'm going to skip all of that. When getting back to the ecology of stable fly larvae, we're addressing these different points in different ways. I'm going to skip all that and just land on this ecosystems ecology, which is looking at energy transformations and nutrient transfers. That's the microbiology part, and that's going to be the next talk after the next one. So. Okay, something to chew on. Okay. Yeah.